Lincoln Inspired is more than just an arts festival, more than a literary festival, more than a whole set of lifestyle opportunities, and more than what the world has needed for a millennia. To see just how much more Lincoln Inspired can make you, go to lincolninspired.co.uk and explore the inspiration.
I know there are those of you who might think, oh, they're starting the Myathon 25-hour route all over again, or 28 hours if you're doing Phil Leonis's Chillpack Hollywood session with Dean Haglund in Los Angeles. No, it's the theme to the George Powell movie classic interpretation, of course, of The Time Machine. And why would we be playing the theme to The Time Machine, Holly?
Because we've got Robert Lloyd Parry on, who is doing a one-man show of The Time Machine.
The Robert Lloyd Parry. Fantastic stuff. Actor and star of the one-man show, The Time Machine, coming to Lincoln Inspired very soon. Robert, how are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me.
A genuine delight. So, this is the sort of thing where you might think, you're insane to actually sort of put this together. I mean, a one-man show doing this whole thing about the Traveller. It's 1895. In a garden, a man lies dazed beside a remarkable machine. He has a story to tell about our future, a story of darkness and light, of fire and fear, of Eloy and Morlocks. Is it a joke, a prophecy, a dream? Holly, you read the book for the first time about a year ago, is that right?
Yep. Yeah. Certainly did.
Yeah, so did you think then you might be able to see this on stage in Lincoln?
No, I certainly didn't. And I'm a bit confused how it's going to work, actually. How's Wiener going to happen?
How's Wiener going to happen, Robert?
Well, I'll tell you what, I mean, if Holly remembers from reading the book, she'll remember that probably about four-fifths of it is a monologue by the time traveller himself. So basically, I've taken that as a cue. It's a piece of performance storytelling. How you decide to picture Wiener, of course, is up to you. I'm not going to bring Wiener onto stage, but there's plenty of very, very vivid description by H.G. Wells that I've adapted for the show that I think ought to allow the viewer to have a pretty good idea of what Wiener is like.
Mm. It's been described by such luminaries as Brian Aldiss as one of the most perfectly formed, essential, almost novellas, really, as opposed to novels that H.G. Wells created during a very, very busy and productive period, during which, of course, he did War of the Worlds, he did The Invisible Man, and, of course, The Island of Dr. Moreau, for Things to Come emerged. Stephen Baxter has described it as probably one of the most significant SF foundation stones ever. What kind of brought and drew you to this whole field, Robert? I mean, are you a fan of the text? Do you always think time? It's just an interesting concept?
Well, yeah, no, what it is I, for a while, I've been doing one-man performances based on ghost stories by M.R. James. Now, they were written in kind of the end of the 19th century, 1890s, early 1900s. I was given the challenge, really, of doing something new, something by a different author. And I just decided I would go back to the stories that I enjoyed as a teenager, those that kind of really affected me in my kind of formative reading experiences. And I went back to look at my bookshelf, and there was The Time Machine. It just leapt out at me again as something that I'd read as a youngster. I'd been thrilled by it, I'd been excited by it, I'd been stimulated by it, and I just reread it and thought this is ideal for a dramatic monologue.
From a candlelight reading of M.R. James' ghost stories in a chapel to visits to the locations of classic films and TV dramas, a journey to the darker side of East Anglia, as indeed was written about in The Guardian, in search of a very British and rural kind of horror. Remember to wrap up warm, says Robert Lloyd Parry, before his trip to see his performance of M.R. James' stories. So it's clear, I mean, the Time Machine is not a ghost story as such. But
it isn't, no. It certainly wasn't. It wasn't the kind of theme that I wanted to continue, but it was kind of a kind of quality of a literary adventure story, I suppose, that's what they have in common. And it's something I think, like the M.R. James, worked very well, told as a first-person kind of confessional, in a way.
Now, obviously, we'll be going over to Los Angeles in a few moments to speak to Phil Leonis. He's always very excited about Sci-Fi Fest, that it's a series of productions, the sci-fi themes on stage. And we've talked about this, obviously. We're just about to launch Sci-Fi London, although he savvy is, another sort of range of fantastic activities from that side of things. Nunky Productions. I mean, I'm looking at the performance schedule. The 24th of April, you're at the Lowry Studio in Salford. In fact, you're there on the 25th with A Pleasing Terror. And then, of course, the 10th of May, ink it in. Ink it in now. Travel with that machine into the future. See it come back and say how fantastic it actually is. It's the Lincoln Drill Hall Time Machine, which is there. That's just astounding. £8 and £6. Surely it should be 80 and 60. Are we not a decimal point out here? Never mind.
Well, you'd think so, wouldn't you? There we are. It's one of the joys of this festival, I think, that it's very affordable.
Well, very much so. And again, hats off to the team for that. Of course, we have the traditional curtain raiser to the quiz around about 1 hour and 15 minutes away now in British time as we head off to the collection to actually launch the traditional Lincoln literary quiz. It's going to be a treat. And I can guarantee, Robert, that the time machine is the subject of one of the questions we'll be asking.
Is it really? Yeah. Dare you ask me that question now? Test me on it.
Well, I could, but please don't give the answer because it would just be unfair from that perspective. When was the Time Machine first published? Actually, if you've been paying attention, you will have actually already heard the answer.
Yes, there you are. We both know that.
Exactly. You know, it's not that difficult. All you need is to pay attention to the show or play it back via podcasts or other such things.
Or go and look at my website. I think it's probably on there.
Well, there is that as well. Of course, you go on from here to perform the Time Machine in Leeds at Carriage Works. Yeah, Leeds, Holly, near York. I know. And then you're at Arlington Arts near Newbury. You're obviously at the Mumford Theatre in Cambridge. Two nights there, I see. So Cambridge obviously double the money for that point. 23rd and 24th
of May. Cambridge is where I live, so that's kind of unfortunate.
Well, that makes, but mind you, surely it's home is where the heart is, isn't it? You know, obviously, we've got the Stafford Gatehouse on Thursday the 29th. And then the Hull Truck is your location for Thursday the 5th of June, followed by Wisbeach and the Chelmsford Cramphorn Theatre. All of this you can actually find on www.nunky.co.uk. I have to ask the question, Robert. Why Nunky? I mean, Numpty.
Well, why Nunky? Well, that's right. There isn't a really terribly hilarious answer. I chose it randomly by opening Brewer's Dictionary of Phrase and Fable and putting my finger blindly on a page. The word Nunky came out. Nunky. It means, it's a corruption of the word uncle. And it's also what the Victorians used to call their pawnbrokers.
You see, I already feel, in many ways, as though you've put in that lovely bid to take over Dictionary Corner from Countdown. just with that line alone. You know, I can see you holding that little white indicator pen and sort of saying, yeah, this is what it's all about. Of course, neither Holly nor Chloe would know about a Countdown because it's daytime television and they've never watched it as a student. It's pointless, really. Chloe, any questions for yourself or Robert? About the production, the time machine, or life in general?
No, I'm just... I'm not the biggest sci-fi fan of the world, but I'm very intrigued by a one-man show. I've never seen one, so...
Oh, right, I will come along. I mean, it's, you know, being a fan of sci-fi isn't... you know, you can still enjoy it. This, as he was saying before, you know, this is a real... This is the first example of the time machine in literature and art. And if you think about how many time machines have been written or drawn or kind of produced or created in special effects departments since that time, it really is an extraordinary kind of landmark.
And there's certainly the argument, Robert, that in many ways, as proto-science fiction at the end of the Victorian era, at the beginning of the Edwardian era, we have here something which certainly, without which, there would be no Doctor Who whatsoever. I mean, arguably, Doctor Who is the Traveller.
Absolutely. I'm trying to kind of whip up excitement about this being the first Time Lord. And, he really is. This is the first guy who travels in a machine through time. There are plenty of other stories before that of people who fall asleep and wake up hundreds of years later. But, no, this is the first guy deliberately in a vehicle. Deliberately making a journey into time.
Yeah. Mark Twain's very own A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court springs to mind.
That kind of thing. Yeah. And you know, these are great stories too. But it was H.G. Wells's brilliant idea, his real vision to come up with this idea of a machine. Yeah. And it seems impossible that it hasn't been around forever, that idea, but it hasn't until the answer to the question you asked in the quiz earlier.
Absolutely. Nicely done. I see what you see. He pays attention. That's what you'd like about, you know, an actor who kind of knows where to feed the line. Yes, very good. Marvellous.
Well, you might also ask how far into the future the time traveller travels.
Well, I did think about that, but I thought, no, I'd be pushing it a wee bit. I mean, you know, these could be double points at this stage, you know. We might use that as a deal-breaker. But, Holly, as we said, you read it for the first time earlier this year. Oh, in fact, last year. So any thoughts from yourself that you'd like to put to Robert about how the thing's being put together or aspects re the tale itself? I mean, did you enjoy it as a text?
Oh, yeah, I really enjoyed it. Yeah, I did. I definitely thought it was strange. Like Robert's saying, the idea that you don't realise it hasn't always been around, and you think, oh, this is the first instance of time travel. And especially once I came in as a new sci-fi reader, or a new reader of sci-fi, and thinking that all these things had already been around, but no, they're all based off Wells, which is, yeah, it's really interesting. But I wondered, going back to staging logistics.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get my head around it.
Well, okay, I mean, it's just me on the stage, and I play it as the traveller, having returned, immediately having arrived back from the very far distant future, so hundreds of millennia into the future.
Is it fair to say you're somewhat dishevelled then?
Dishevelled is one way of putting it, yeah. And I have as a central prop in the show a machine. It's in fact a 10-foot high metronome that I can climb in and out of and all over and so on. And this becomes a kind of multi-purpose prop for telling the story, but is also, of course, the time machine itself. So I call it performance storytelling, really. It's not kind of drama in the sense that there's a cast and you witness dialogue and scenes between various characters. You listen to someone narrating their story. And obviously, I've had to kind of condense a lot of Wells's text, because even though it is a novella, it's a very short piece of writing, to fit it into an hour and a half worth of monologue. I've had to pare a lot of it down. But it hasn't been too difficult a job, you know. H.G. Wells, he paces the story brilliantly. He structures it brilliantly. It's a really wonderfully shaped story. And, I think it does bear up to listening and hearing. And if the audience are prepared to exercise a bit of their own imagination as well, then it pays dividends.
7:30 p.m. at the Lincoln Drill Hall on Saturday the 10th of May in the year of our Lord 2014 AD, Gregorian calendar, just to set those whole routines. It's The Time Machine with, as we just heard, Nunky Productions' very own creator and genius Robert Lloyd Parry sorting things through, and it's well worth attending. I'm looking forward to that with great anticipation, Robert. Two final questions. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic debut on this Lincoln-inspired pre-packaged show that we've put together this evening on the Midweek Drive?
I've enjoyed it very much indeed, yes.
So can we look forward to connecting with you again in the very near future, and obviously touching base with you, hopefully, when you're in Lincoln itself?
Absolutely. I'll be in Lincoln itself the day before the show, so, yeah, I'd love to do that.
Round of applause for Robert Lloyd Parry, please. Thanks. Yes, go, let's show that excitement. Coming up next, Phil Lienus from Los Angeles, in his PJs, but now China Crisis, wishful thinking. Robert Lloyd Parry, we salute you. Take care now.
Cheers, thanks a lot. Bye.
Say the same thing about every Chillpack Hollywood episode. There's no secrets kept in here.
From LA to Lincoln and via sirenonline.co.uk to the world, it's time for the Midweek Drive to connect with investigative filmmaker and planetary truth seeker, the one, the only, Phil Lienus.
So, Holly, your first show, and you get a chance to speak to the Lienus Meister. Did you manage to actually do a bit of Googling on him, or searching and such like, to find out what he's actually done in life?
You found... Is it a blog? I don't know. A website?
Blog, a website, I don't know. You tell me.
Some sort of
thing. It's some sort of thing.
Yeah. I'm sorry, that's awful.
Nice.
that's an awful answer.
Let's be honest, you didn't expect to be on there. You thought you'd just sit back and search. It's marvellous. You've done extraordinarily well, as I'm sure Phil will actually share with us. Chloe, of course, I know you were very impressed with Phil Lienus. So impressed that it's been a year since you last returned. Jodie Orton's back on the show next week.
Is she?
Yeah, she is.
Long time, is he?
Well, you won't see her. She's on a phone link from London. But there we are, it's a different line. Anyway, Phil Lienus, welcome back to the Midweek Drive, and we gather you're fully dressed. Not that that's anything to do with, it's not that sort of strange sort of format, Holly, just in case you're wondering, but anyway, you are fully dressed.
Yeah, I mean, now that you've yanked the webcam from my remote location, what's the point? What's the point of being in my pajamas?
This
really?
So true. Indeed.
I no longer have an image to uphold, so I might as well be fully dressed. No, I work straight through the night. So much going on, as you know. And I must say, I don't think this show is big enough for both Jodie Orton and myself. I'm going to be unavailable next Wednesday.
Wow.
My usual time slot. Yeah.
Hey. Well, is Lily stepping into the breach?
No, Lily will be with me, and we'll be with Dean Haglund in the ongoing and oft-referenced Chilpak Hollywood lawsuit of the week, in which we are the principal players.
Fair enough, Ski. Well, anyway, if there is anybody you'd like to suggest, obviously we're more than happy to take that, if anybody could step into your more than capable shoes. But meanwhile, we need to find out what Leonis notes and Leonis wanderings have been, Phil's ponderings in many ways, Phil's perspectives on the midweek drive that we've just, well, we're almost in the last 15 minutes or so from wrapping the whole thing up in a neat little ball and going off to the collection at Lincoln to deliver the Lincoln-inspired traditional curtain raiser, the quiz.
Wow, that is, so I'm the opening act then for that. That is quite exciting. What a good show. I mean, three big themes that are near and dear to my heart. Animal intelligence, Shakespeare, science fiction. Where does one begin? Alex, did you hear on Chilpak Hollywood Hour, of course, the weekly podcast I co-host with the X-Files Dean Haglund each and every week at ChilpakHollywood.com. Did you hear this week when Dean described the one-act play based on which was a one-act play written by Ray Bradbury called Kaleidoscope? Did you hear when he described how they're staging this here in Los Angeles this coming month?
Well, I have to be honest, no. Because once I actually didn't manage to sort of spend a Tuesday tuning into yourself because I was so busy sorting out the second marking, a variety of other bits and pieces, plus, of course, the Lincoln-inspired on-air shows we're putting together here on Siren FM. But I have it on my list of things to do, Phil.
Well, it is going to be quite a fantastic... It was a wonderful short story by Ray Bradbury, and for those who don't know, SciFest is taking place here in May in Los Angeles. It's the first ever of its kind fringe festival of one-act plays in the science fiction genre, written by the likes of Ray Bradbury and Ursula K. Le Guin. And if people listen to the show, they'll hear Dean describe how they're staging this. But it's basically the movie Gravity on stage with several different astronauts cast adrift with only enough life support to support them for the duration of the one-act play. And what I love about it is, you know, science fiction and film were such a brilliant marriage in this last century because film is so readily able to embody the language of dreams, the body of the imagination. And science fiction has always been a genre that sought to harness a viewer or a reader's imagination, their own creativity, to be able to tackle issues of how time is perceived and how that perception can be transcended. I'm always amused when people say that they're not really science fiction fans because if we went through a list of probably their 20 favorite films, I bet a handful of them would actually be science fiction and they didn't even think about it. But also, movies themselves are really the language of science fiction. When you think of it, we allow compression of time, expansion of time, time travel in any story, whether it's a period piece, whether it's a romantic comedy. There's flashbacks, there's flash forwards, there's fantasies coming to life in these films, and that is at the heart of so much science fiction. So anyway, for a century, what a marriage that was. But now I find that it really is going back to the theater, to that dream space where at a time when obviously through CGI and computers we can realistically create any visual so you can look at it and believe it's real, there's a certain degree to which now film doesn't seem to harness a viewer's imagination. And so we return to the stage where we must imagine the surroundings and thereby really become closer to the character's plight. Which, of course, is always what Shakespeare himself was doing. He was trying to transport us so that we could imagine a faraway and often long-ago world and thereby become closer to the characters and learn something about our present day. I think if Shakespeare was around today, he would be a science fiction writer, quite frankly.
So let's open that up to discussion. Holly, thoughts on Phil's little monologue there?
Do you think the fact that people engaging with the stage again in regards to science fiction. Do you think that's coming because all this CGI stuff is now too easy? You're saying it doesn't quite harness the imagination anymore. Perhaps it's because it's not a challenge for them to produce it anymore.
Well, I think it's always a challenge. Look, any movie, no matter how bad, is an incredible challenge to make. Making movies is really, really hard work, which is why most of them don't work well. So I don't think it's that it's not a challenge.
But in comparison to the staging on a theatre?
Well, yeah, for the storytellers, you have to use creativity. When you are dealing with the limitations of the stage, and the more you use creativity, the more you're inviting an audience to participate in that rather than to sit back and just open themselves to the experience. But I also think there's financial elements at play. I think movies cost a great deal of money. And in order to make sure we recoup that money, we gravitate towards elements that we know we can market to an audience, big action sequences. There were movies in the last year, big budget science fiction movies like Oblivion or Elysium, that at their heart, and I bet in their original screenplay form, were really compelling stories. But by the time they got to screen, they were bloated action epics. They were so far removed from what their original ideas were because they felt like, wow, these effects are costing a lot of money. We better put in a lot of big battle sequences in order to be able to sell it to a mass audience. In theater, you don't have that kind of huge financial burden placed upon you. So I think that's part of it. And then finally, I think, too little of creating an actor's performance, sadly, in what are supposedly visual mediums of film and television, actually involve actors getting to embody anything. Because so much of what we see is maybe motion capture at best, but a lot of times the whole stories are told in close-up, or they are CGI, or they're stunt people. And on stage, you actually get to see from head to toe a human being and how they embody the experience of the story. And that, no matter what genre you're in, has to be the key component, I think. Story comes out of character, and we reveal character through how we embody what we are experiencing.
Of course, I would just say there is a slight exception to what Phil's been saying in terms of blockbuster work, as Louis Savvy and Sci-Fi London will ably demonstrate, because as indeed Ilana Rain has shown, you don't have to have massive budgets to make good science fiction movies. So raise that.
Or any kind of movie.
Exactly. I mean, Joss Whedon has just released his motion picture free. It's, for $5, and it's available to download. There we are.
And speaking of Shakespeare, if that movie he'd released for free had been his adaptation of Midsummer Night, free would have still been way too expensive.
Hey. Please, steady. Don't mention grr, arg.
You know I enjoy Joss Whedon. I'm a fan. I like Shakespeare. Joss Whedon doing Shakespeare is not something I ever need to see
again. You had Alexis Denisoff in there. You had Ranger.
She was terrible.
Please.
I always give actors the benefit of the doubt, though, because directors can ruin an actor's performance, and indeed editors can ruin it all the more. So I always give actors the benefit of the doubt. Do we have time to talk about Shakespeare for a minute?
Or? We do. It is his birthday, after all, and day in which he also passed on. So 23rd of April, also shared with Adolf Hitler, but I haven't mentioned him apart from that time there. But there we are. Life continues.
I'm a graduate of the UCLA Film School, and once at the UCLA Film School, the late Cubby Broccoli, the founder of Eon Productions and the producer of the first... how many was it, Bond films? And now, of course, it's still his estate that produces the Bond films. He was once asked, upon winning a Lifetime Achievement Academy Award, about his contribution to cinema. And he said famously, look, we're not doing Shakespeare, we're just doing entertainment. And it really, left a bad taste in many of our mouths because it sent this impression that Shakespeare isn't wildly entertaining. And, of course, it seems to fulfill this kind of odd impression of Shakespeare that's developed over the last that century, that it's something for academics, as opposed to what it was, which was entertainment for the masses.
Bring your own tomatoes.
This is incredibly open and available material for an audience, but you really hit it on the head in the earlier segment when we need to remind ourselves that Shakespeare is meant to be watched, it's meant to be heard. It's wonderful literature, absolutely, and we should study it. But this idea that that's how it is best engaged is absolutely wrong. This was meant to be enjoyed with an audience and to be read aloud. And when you hear it in that setting, when you see it performed, what becomes very obvious quickly is that the language is no barrier, because the emotions are always on the surface. The intentions, the characters are always readily apparent. You can follow the story, and they're rich characters. And oh, by the way, when we're talking about entertainment, we're talking about stories with witches, with swordplay, with magical spells, with flashbacks, with passionate love affairs, with shipwrecks. What could be more big budget entertainment than Shakespeare?
And I hope
we reclaim that sense of it, that this is entertainment for all of us. It is not meant for the scholars.
Time, methinks, for a dollop of Dooley inspiration.
The secret behind miracles is that the one performing them begins without any knowledge whatsoever of exactly how they will succeed. Yet still, they begin. When you move, I move the universe. Once again, taking action saves the day.
Something to bear in mind when you actually take that lawsuit next week, Phil. Taking action saves the day. But not necessarily.
Oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry, Alex. I just got information that the show is big enough for Jody Orton and me. The appearance is 2 weeks.
Oh, you see?
2 weeks.
And that's the joy of having your own personal time machine. Or is
that... Do you know who told me that just now? Who reminded me of that?
Was that Lily Holloman? Or was it Jody Orton?
It was, in fact, Fuzz Aldrin.
It was Fuzz Aldrin, you see? Exactly, yeah. Penny Evans would like to say, Phil just mentioned the Bond films. He did, Penny. You're absolutely right. She finally watched Skyfall a few nights ago with her husband. Only I knew M was going to... plot spoiler. And obviously, Phil had let that slip on air. Never mind.
Zebedee arrived. Time for bed, I think, he said.
No, it's not.
Already, said Florence.
It's time for the Lincoln-inspired quiz, which we're heading off to. Phil, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the show today?
Unreasonably interesting, as always.
Would you like to put those two questions to Holly, because it's been her first ever show here? Holly Parker has made her debut on the Midweek Drive, and it's always a very special moment, as you well recall, Phil. So let's just quiz Holly on how she's found the whole experience.
Well, I'm not going to. I'm going to have to rewrite the question because there was no telephonic link involved.
No, with
Holly, of course. Yeah. So, Holly, have you had a reasonably interesting debut appearance on the Midweek Drive for Siren FM and South Pride Broadcasting?
Oh, definitely. Considering I thought I was just going to be coming down to listen, I would say that it's pretty involved.
You attended my seminars. You know I don't like to have students just sitting there. I don't get them involved, etc. It's very important.
I know, but I wish we were told this first.
Oh. It's only when Annette Andre and Phil Lernis are on the air that everybody has to just sit back and listen. Yeah.
I see. Penny has chastised me. She said it was me who let it slip, not yourself, Phil. All right, somebody dies in Skyfall. Well, they'd expect it to happen. It's a Bond movie, for goodness sakes. I don't know. Ed Wellman's arrived, so we'll be okay for co-hosting the quiz. Marvellous stuff there.
Yeah, and you know what that was that died in Skyfall? It was my hope that the Bond films will ever display a positive view of women. Okay,
yeah.
So the second question for Holly is, Holly, can we look forward to enjoying your good self again on the Midweek Drive?
I certainly hope so.
Yay. Conlowy, have you enjoyed your return?
I have.
Back again soon?
Yep.
Yay! To Cameron Tilbury, Annette Andre, to Lula Randall, we thank you to Lula, even though we didn't manage to speak with you. William Coles, Robert Lloyd Parry, and Phil Leonis, thank you. Thank you, dear listener. Thank you, Penny Evans. And Phil, we'll see you again next week, all being well.
Absolutely.
Can we all say bye-bye?
Bye.
Bye. Bye.